G'day, humans. Welcome to the safe space for dangerous ideas, and a lot of dangerous ideas floating around at the moment. Iran being the biggest of them. A lot of people asking me what I think about the American and Israeli strike on Iran. Most of the coverage and analysis seems to be, look, he was a bad guy, Khamenei, and the regime was terrible, but this is illegal, and so, and we don't know what is going to come of it. And I think I just broadly agree with that rather boring and banal interpretation, unfortunately. If, you know, the Iranian people are a fabulous culture and an amazing people and incredibly industrious and innovative and culturally self-aware and sophisticated. And so I've long felt that they've been imprisoned for the past nearly four decades under crazy, dictatorial, theocratic idiots, jihadist death cultists who just want the worst for Western civilization and for Jews and women, and the list goes on. So on a narrow level, was a little part of me happy when Khamenei was reported dead? Absolutely. And I sort of admire the gumption of finally trying to do something about the situation. But it's clear that there is no rationale, either under international law or under American law, for doing this. Iran posed no threat. In fact, the very fact that it was so unthreatening at the moment because it had been so successfully degraded in the strikes in the middle of last year against its nuclear facilities, and so thoroughly degraded by a succession of incredible Israeli security operations like the exploding pagers on Hezbollah in Lebanon and targeted assassinations in Iran. That's why it made this such a low cost and achievable outcome for the Americans and the Israelis. So the very grounds on which one might want to base a rationale for a preemptive war, namely that your adversary is formidable and an imminent threat, are the very reason why this undertaking was taken now. I mean, the fact that those conditions were not met. It's not just legalistic, persnickety nonsense to care about international law and American law. These are the, international law, perhaps one can make an argument, is easier to ignore since even the Iraq war was in contravention of international law. It didn't have Security Council approval. And perhaps it's unreasonable to expect Russia and China to sign off on every international adventure. But Americans should insist on abiding by American law. The Constitution was very good at breaking up the rights, the abilities, the capabilities of a monarch into a bunch of different buckets and giving some of those capabilities to one of three branches of government, the judiciary and the legislative branch and the executive. And when it came to war, they thought, well, why don't we break it up into the declaring of war and then the running of a war? So we'll split it apart. We'll make sure that no individual branch has all of the powers of any particularly important thing, and we'll give the legislative branch the ability to declare a war, and then once a war is underway, it's the executive branch that figures out how to run the war, which is the basic way that the American system is supposed to work anyway. It's supposed to be Congress, the House of Representatives, and the Senate together that make the decisions about, they pass the laws about what's going to happen, and then the executive branch, the president and whoever he picks, are the people who then do whatever Congress has instructed them to do, and they do the running of it. They do the operational side of things, whereas the big picture stuff is all taken care of by the legislative branch. I mean, that just doesn't exist anymore, and it should worry Americans that it doesn't exist anymore, because you were supposed to live in a republic. You're not supposed to live in an elected monarchy where for 4 years one person gets to do whatever they want, including things that are explicitly allocated to the other branches. And the mere fact that one of the branches is so dickless that they're unwilling to stand up for themselves and insist on that it's their right to declare war and nobody else's, does not make it okay. So Trump should have gone to Congress and he should have gotten approval, congressional approval. At least George W. Bush did that before the Iraq war, even though he snubbed his nose at the fact that the UN Security Council voted against it. So I worry about the legal precedent in the United States of, essentially one person being able to take out any other country just because that person doesn't like it without having to provide a cogent or coherent rationale, not just to the international community, but even to the elected representatives of the American people. And the other thing that worries me a bit about it is just the uncertainty and the riskiness of it. I admire the chutzpah. I admire the sense that, you know, nobody has been able to solve this situation, so we're just going to roll the dice and take our chances and see what happens. And if it becomes possible for the Iranian people to rise up, and if American and Israeli firepower is able to neuter the Iranian Revolutionary Guard to such an extent that those uprisings are successful and there is a genuine people's revolution, then it will all have been worth it. And that is fabulous. But that is not currently, I would say, the most likely outcome. And there are a bunch of other possibilities on the table that gave pause to Trump's predecessors. So I don't think it's as simple as saying, look, Trump has managed to do what none of his predecessors managed to pull off, which is, you know, destabilize the Iranian regime, this terrible, bloodthirsty, pariah state of religious lunatics. You know, the reason why, it's not like his predecessors didn't know how. They knew that they could authorize this kind of military action. And it's not that they didn't have the balls. It's that they thought that the possible ramifications were bad enough that the status quo was preferable to rolling those dice. The calculus is a bit different for Israel because it sees Iran's nuclear program and, in fact, the theocracy in Iran itself as an existential threat to Israel. And they think that that certain factions in Iran, the ruling faction up until this week, would essentially be suicidal in wanting to take out Israel. We don't know whether that's Israeli paranoia or not, but it certainly puts a different slant on things than they have in the United States. So I just feel, watch this space. I'm both impressed and also worried about the whole thing. The only thing I can say about the media coverage is it is so tiresome to me to see reports about like people's flights being disrupted because they were flying Emirates Airlines and then they weren't going to be able to, their flight was canceled through Dubai, and there was another piece in the paper, and these are like, this is like the second most important piece in, you know, the online news, and then like the fourth biggest piece about Iran was there's a Sydney woman whose mother is in an Iranian prison, and she's worried about her mother's welfare in this Iranian prison. One of the reasons why I got out of the legacy media was this endless, relentless attempt to sort of find like these banal parochial human interest stories in everything. I remember in 2017, when I was sort of having a job interview with some of the producers at the public broadcaster, and they said, well, so what would you want to, what would be a, give us an example of a story that you would want to pursue now? And this was 2017, and my first word that I said was Russia, which was not a fun thing to talk about in 2017, or not even on people's radar very much in 2017, because the Crimean War had happened and the attack on Georgia had happened. But I just knew that Russia was going to be a big problem. I didn't know it would unfold exactly as Ukraine has unfolded, but I knew that it was going to be a problem. And I was like, I think we need to be paying more attention to Russia. I think things are worse than we think they are. The lead producer, there was an awkward silence as everyone thought, this guy doesn't have a clue what he's talking about. He doesn't understand the way that you deliver news to the public, to the little man who doesn't care about Russia. And she said, so imagine I'm a housewife and I'm driving along in Sydney and I turn on the radio. How does what I'm hearing impact my life as, say, a mother driving along in rush hour in Sydney? And I thought, well, if that's the prism that you're going to put all information through, how does it affect the life of a woman driving along in Sydney? Then most of the most important things that we need to be talking about would be off the table, because they might not have an immediate impact on her afternoon. But I think there's something condescending about thinking that that woman wouldn't be interested in knowing about a country that, sure enough, 5 years later launched the first war in Europe since World War II. I think she might have liked to have, for that to have been on her radar. And I think it might have been the responsibility of the public broadcaster to put it on her radar in 2017. Needless to say, I didn't do stories about Russia because I was constantly encouraged to do stories that would have a real human bread and butter impact and be relatable to people. Well, The success of this show and shows like it show that people like you who consume this show are more interested in things bigger than just what is going to affect your afternoon. Otherwise, we would just do the weather all day. So my sense now is it's time for thinking about the sort of big picture stuff, the rules of war, the international rules, legal rules, whether or not we're likely to get anywhere with an administration whose idea of regime change in Venezuela was just to replace one person with that person's deputy and then claim success does not give me huge hope that what will eventuate in Iran is going to be much more than a cosmetic change. But I could be wrong. So who knows? I'd like to feel that this is a moment like the fall of the Berlin Wall. But as I read one commentator say, the successor to Khamenei is unlikely to be a Nelson Mandela. It's more likely to be a Gorbachev. But even if it was a Gorbachev, I would take it. Today, we're talking about something related to Iran, but not exactly on, you know, following. Oh, I should mention, if you want the sort of moment-by-moment strategic breakdown of where we are on Iran, then on Wednesday evening, if you're listening to this in the few days after it posts, Wednesday evening at 8 p.m. Eastern time in the United States, that's Thursday morning in Australia, we'll be speaking with David Frum, who is currently at The Atlantic. He was George W. Bush's speechwriter, one of the architects of the Iraq War back in the day. And as an anti-Trump Republican, he knows a lot about the potential ramifications of Middle Eastern conflicts and the way that such engagements can go sideways. So you'll be able to tune in live for that. If you're a Primo subscriber, you'll be able to watch it after the fact, or you'll be able to listen to it on the podcast feed on Friday, Australian time. Thursday in the US. Today's conversation is about the way that artificial intelligence is evolving in warfare and the sort of dystopian and asymmetric way it could impact all of our lives in terms of the conflicts that we find ourselves embroiled in and exactly what they look like and the civilian casualties therein as well. Toby Walsh is probably Australia's leading artificial intelligence expert. He actually gave a National Press Club speech last week, which is sort of our annual big speechifying honor, saying that regulation of artificial intelligence is, risks leading to supercharged AI, which will inflict supercharged harms on all of us. He's the chief scientist at the AI Institute at the University of New South Wales. He's a professor of AI at UNSW. He has a degree in theoretical physics and mathematics from Cambridge University and a PhD in artificial intelligence. He was the editor-in-chief of the Journal of Artificial Intelligence Research and of AI Communications. So this is his bag, and he was kind enough to stop by the Uncomfortable Conversation Studios literally on his way to the airport to fly to Geneva to take part in a United Nations conversation about artificial intelligence in war. Now, the reason why I wanted to talk to Toby this week was because the biggest story of the week, had it not been for the invasion of Iran, would be, it's funny to say invasion since there are no troops on the ground, but you can't really call it a war because war wasn't declared either. It's so funny how we live in this hybrid Schrodinger state of like war and not war at the same time. But the reason why we wanted to talk to him this week was because this huge story happened a few days ago where Anthropic, which is probably the best AI, the producer of the best AI right now, Claude is their consumer-facing product, but they have had a long-standing contract with the Pentagon. They refused to renew their contract with the Pentagon unless the Pentagon was willing to accept a couple of limits on what it was allowed to use artificial intelligence for. It wasn't allowed to create autonomous killing machines, and it wasn't allowed to spy on Americans. The Pentagon refused. Anthropic called their bluff and said, well, you can't have it then. And Trump countercalled the bluff and said, all right, everything's off. Anthropic has to be removed from no collaboration with the Pentagon, no collaboration with any American agencies at all. And then most recently, Anthropic's competitor, OpenAI, jumped in and supposedly replace them and signed a contract with the Pentagon instead. Massive, massive, massive business, massive reverberations around Silicon Valley, massive reverberations around the way that military strategists think about insinuating and embedding AI into their systems. Toby is a delightful person to talk to. I hope that you'll also enjoy the conversation with David Frum about Iran on Wednesday or Thursday. Please enjoy, as much as I did, the one, the only, Toby Walsh. It's weird that this is not the biggest story of the week, but in a weird way, tangentially, it sort of almost is. Let's start with Iran, because why not? To what extent is technology responsible for what we're seeing in Iran?
I don't think you would see what we're seeing today without the advances that technology, things like artificial intelligence, the precision that you can attack now, and the scale and speed, transformed by the technology.
Yeah.
So the fact that you can actually go in and take out the leader.
Do we know how that was done? I mean, I assumed it was human intelligence. I assumed it was old fashioned. A Mossad spy was in the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps and knew where he was. But that might just be because I watched too many Cold War era.
No, I think you're right. It was probably embedded spies, Israeli embedded spies in the regime, who fed back information very quickly to where he was. Mm. And they had, they would have probably had to have confirmation from independent sources that that was where he was.
I also heard some rumor that...
But then the precision of the strike. Then
just right, I see. You mean just the actual technical precision, yeah, of being able to aim the bomb, yeah, right there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Although I suspect the US doesn't have many Tomahawks left now.
You think they've been using them with gay abandon a little too much?
Yeah, used like half the reserve.
Right.
So if this is going to go on for any length of time.
Hmm. I mean, it helps when your adversary doesn't have anything either.
They don't have a credible defense.
It's funny, isn't it? They've spent so much. I mean, I heard an analyst talking about how Iran has really invested all of its defense budget in proxies who can create mischief throughout the region, in the nuclear program, and sort of in these other sort of big ticket things that don't actually help you protect the homeland. But they don't have like missile launchers and things. They might have 400 missile launchers or something like that, which every time you fire it, the Americans or the Israelis take it out.
Yeah.
So you better pick your 400 wisely and make sure they're not shot out of the sky. What do you make of it just politically and globally, the moment that we're in?
As usual with Trump, you wonder, what is his end game? Has he actually thought through how is this going to end? I don't see stirring this hornet's nest up. I mean, they're saying it's regime change, and the regime has changed because you've taken out the leader, the supreme leader, but supposedly there's just hardliners who are going to come behind. So I don't see the Iranian people rising up and taking back control.
Mm. Yes. I mean, civilians are unarmed, and the Revolutionary Guard Corps is very, very, very armed.
And brutal.
And totally brutal.
Yes.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, obviously one is pleased that someone as evil as that has gone, but I don't see that being necessarily changing the situation on the ground in a positive sense in the long term.
I mean,
it's a fantastic distraction for the president.
Well, it's funny, isn't it, when you think about what he did in Venezuela, which is just take out the bad guy, but then let the bad guy's deputy just continue ruling in the same party and the same...
We're getting the same here again.
Yeah, so it's hard to know.
It's not... the president doesn't have a lot of follow-through.
That's not even one of his strengths. No. I wouldn't say that's his top five.
No.
Yeah,
because he hasn't got a big game plan.
Attention to detail.
Right, he hasn't got a big game plan, right?
No. But I guess it's like
whatever someone whispered in his ear last.
I mean, to be generous to him, I do think that he just senses that if things haven't worked for almost 40 years, then why don't you try the risky option that nobody else wanted to try and see what happens? Because you might end up with someone, the cleric who replaces Khamenei.
If you shake the dice enough times, eventually you do get a double.
That's right, exactly. Yes. That's right. Roll the dice. It's a craps table.
Yeah.
You may end up with someone who is still a dictator but is more amenable to the West. Or you may end up with someone, the clerics may be ousted by the IRGC, you may end up with a more fanatical, more fundamentalist, terrorist sympathizing character who just wants to invest all of their money in funding proxies to carry out spectacular mega terrorism operations in Western cities. And you just don't know which one you're going to get, or a decade of civil war.
Yeah. I think it's interesting, though, to see that the Western allies have not come behind this.
Mm.
Except for one exception, the only country.
The little prime country minister, that could. The mouse that could. Board is Australia.
Exactly.
Which came out
the
today
only country that,
way back
that has really backed it. Mm. The others have been conspicuous by their silence and by saying, yes, he was an evil guy, but, we want to They haven't, you know, it hasn't been a full-throated support of the
And did you US see that?
Position. They haven't used UK bases, apparently.
Right. And a journalist asked, I think it was the foreign minister or the defence minister here in Australia, after the government said, oh, this is great, this is a great idea, we love this attack on Iran, they said, did Australia provide any tactical support in any way, or was there any intelligence or anything that was gathered on Australian soil? And they said, no, we weren't told or asked. But we want to get the credit from the American administration anyway for at least having supported it.
We have turned up to every conflict since the Second World War to support the Americans.
This is true. So, artificial intelligence in warfare. The thing that made me reach out to you over the weekend was this. I was fascinated by these internecine battles between Anthropic and the Pentagon and Trump and Palantir. And I didn't quite know how they all link together and what it is that war makers want to be able to use AI for, that even AI bosses themselves, who are not known for their heedfulness when it comes to experimentation in new technologies,
to give
are leery about.
Anthropic their credit, they do try and advertise themselves as the most...
They do.
As the most careful, the most conscientious, safe...
They do.
AI company around. Indeed, you know, it was some refugees from OpenAI who left because they didn't feel that OpenAI was being safe enough who set up Anthropic.
Yes. I mean, but they did also have to... Didn't they originally say that if they felt like AI was getting out of control, that they would shut it down? And then last year they said, actually, it is getting out of control, but we're not going to shut it down because if we shut it down, then everybody else will go full steam ahead anyway. We're better to do it than everybody else.
It's even more current than that. Indeed, you know, one cynical interpretation of the fact that the Anthropic have stood up against the Pentagon so vigorously, it lost a $200 million contract with the Pentagon, is as a distraction from what they announced just a week or two back.
Oh, it's that reason.
Yes.
Okay, right.
Which is that they are going to backtrack on their firm safety promise, which is they would not release any leading AI models if they couldn't guarantee that they were going to be safe. And they've watered that down, saying, well, we'll only guarantee they're safe if we're at the frontier, we're the leading maker of models. If we're behind, if we're playing catch up, then we don't care.
Right, because there are worse people out there anyway.
Because there are already worse things out there.
So. Yeah. Oh, God. Okay, so what were the dynamics of the actual disagreement between Anthropic and the Pentagon? What did the Pentagon want to be able to do?
Well, so Anthropic had actually got in bed with the DoD very quickly. They were the first language model to be approved to be run on secure hardware. I think many people think they've probably got slightly better model than most people. And certainly, by all accounts, within the Pentagon, they're the preferred model that they like using.
At this point, I know a lot of creatives who think that Claude is superior to anything, which is the Anthropic user, consumer-facing LLM.
And as far as we know, the Venezuela military action was planned with the help of Anthropic Claude.
Really?
Yes.
Right, I guess it must have been. Do we know how?
I expect it was some of the high-level planning, thinking, you know, war gaming, strategizing, planning how to, you know, coordinate the activities.
Mm.
It's quite a good tool for doing those sorts of things.
Yes. It also seemed to plan out some of Trump's tariffs. If you looked at the countries that were targeted for the tariffs, you remember last year when it was like, there were these bizarre, people were like, why would you get those tariffs on those countries? And then someone plugged into... I think it was ChatGPT.
You asked for the principal formula for tariffs.
Yeah, it was like the difference. It was the trade imbalance or something divided by something or other. And then you got these numbers.
And indeed, if you applied that formula to Australia, we should have had a negative tariff. But anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
We got a trade surplus. We didn't get a trade, a negative tariff.
So anyway, the Pentagon's using AI to, for war games, planning, like what's the best way to... get this guy and whatever else. But at what point does Anthropic start saying far but no further?
They have a contract with the Department of Defense. It's not clear why they were renegotiating the terms of the contract. You know, a cynic would say Pete Hegseth was looking for some good publicity. But at any rate, Anthropic said there are two things that we will not permit our AI models to be used for. One was for mass domestic surveillance, which of course is against the Fourth Amendment anyway. And the second was for lethal autonomous weapons. As far as we know, they're not actually using the language models for lethal autonomous weapons. Other types of AI would be used. So not clear why that was such a contentious point in the sand, but certainly you can imagine that I would be unsurprised if the security services aren't, some of the three-letter agencies aren't using language models to help them sift through huge amounts of domestic surveillance and so on.
Mm. I suppose from the Pentagon, yeah.
Both of those technically are, you know, already governed by existing law. So the Fourth Amendment prohibits domestic surveillance.
That's the unreasonable search and seizure, or is it? Yeah.
So and the US military have a Directive 3009, which requires appropriate human oversight of AI in use in autonomous weapon systems.
Ah, right. When's that from?
So that's the US military who themselves decided the first bit of major AI weapon regulation themselves. You know, it's not required. That was set up in 2012.
Right.
First set of 12, and it was, it's been reapproved at various times, most recently in 2023. They revised it up again.
Oh, I mean, you wouldn't have trusted a computer in 2012. You wouldn't have trusted like MS-DOS in 2012 figure out the difference between a terrorist and a shopkeeper. But in 2026, you might.
We've all seen AI make silly mistakes. And that's one of the challenges here, which is that it is not 100% reliable. And if it makes mistakes, who's going to be held accountable?
Why wouldn't the same chain of command be held accountable that is supposedly held accountable when humans make mistakes?
Well, it is in the US military. It's according to this directive requires the humans to be held accountable in the same chain of command. But the problem is if you minimize the role of humans in the decision-making loop, and the problem is that, you know, decision-making is getting faster and faster, then can they really be held accountable?
Well, they're not held accountable anyway. I mean, you know, like Abu Ghraib happens and some low-level functionaries have the book thrown at them. But the culture that permitted the abuse of, detainees, Cheney and Rumsfeld and Bush are fine, and so are the generals.
Yes.
So,
that's the interesting thing. So ADFA, the defense training college here for military officials, military officers, they did a survey of young military officers, and they were most concerned about the uptake of AI because they realized they were the ones that were going to be held accountable for the mistakes. Not the generals.
Right.
They're going to be held accountable. And so they were most concerned.
But suppose you had a system where there was accountability, and that if there is a systemic issue like waterboarding of prisoners or something like that, one of the obvious, you know, examples that we can think of from recent history in which militaries have done things that were in contravention of human rights and probably international law. If you assume that you had a system where there was accountability all the way up to the authorizing figure, whether that's a general or the Minister for Defense or the Secretary of Defense, why would it make a difference whether the person on the ground who was who was pushing a button for a drone to blow up an Iranian military facility, whether that was a person making the decision or whether that was an AI making the decision, as long as accountability for the person giving the command that authorized the underling to make the call is ultimately accountable?
Because I fear you'd be throwing the person under the bus. Because, you know, two of the fundamental principles of international humanitarian law under which we fight war, under which you can prosecute people at the Hague and so on, are the principle of distinction, that you can't target civilians, you have to target valid military targets. And if we're handing over those decisions, can we be sure that the machine is making the right decision? And then the second principle, one of proportionality, which is that you're only allowed to use as much force as proportional to the threat you face. And that's a very subtle thing. And it's not clear that machines have the capability to make those sort of subtle calls. And certainly when you look at, you know, what was happening in Gaza, you look at, you know, AI was being used for, to make the targeting decisions, systems like Lavender and Where's Daddy that were processing vast amounts of military intelligence, social media and all the information they were getting back in as to where the Hamas targets were going to be. You saw the collateral damage. You know, it was 10-50 to 1. That you're thinking, well, that doesn't seem to me like that's representing proportional to the threat, that you are allowed to, you know, kill 50 civilians for the one high target.
Yeah, but I sometimes feel like, I mean, speaking of people being scapegoats, I sometimes feel like that the systems are being used as scapegoats as well, because that disproportionality in Gaza was taking place in a context of a government in Israel that had absolutely no care, apparently, for the proportionality of their conflict, right? Well, I mean, so AI was on instruction just as a human would have been, maybe not on overt instruction, but was operating in a context in which it was clear to everybody who was looking at it that the position of the Israeli government was, we're sick of this shit, we don't give a fuck about any of them, we're going to do whatever we have to do because they've got our people and no one's going to treat us like this. Like there was that obvious revenge kind of, you know, knee-jerk, hostile, that they weren't taking time to think about, okay, well, maybe we could get the women and children out and we could put them in the Israeli Sinai and we could, you know, maybe flood the tunnels and just target that. It was like, we're going to do what has to be done and we're not going to be good guys about this. So then, of course, the AI that you deploy in that context behaves that way, but I would put it to you that a human Israeli, that Netanyahu would have done that as well.
He would. The difference is that it then changes the cadence of battle, so that they were spitting out targets far quicker than the human analysts could ever spit out the targets.
Right. So it becomes a rat-a-tat-tat machine gun of sort of AI targets.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when the numbers start, when you started to see the data coming out, I remember saying, as far as, you know, we don't know that much about these systems, but either they're inaccurate or the IDF do not care. I think the reality is it was both.
Right. Maybe. Yeah, I suppose we don't know. Well, let's park the inaccuracy then. Let's assume that we know that it's more accurate.
Right, but the other thing that, you know, behind that is it's changing the character of war, right, in a way that is, you know, as we've seen technologies in the past, change the character of war in a way that makes war possibly a more deadly, a more difficult proposition.
Right. In what way more deadly and difficult?
Well, I mean, you see it in Ukraine. You see that, you know, it's some strange mixture between the First World War and some 22nd century war, right? It's some, you know, they're bogged down. I mean, in that sense, the technology has been a good thing. The technology has allowed the Ukrainians to resist an oppressor, you know, an attacker who's 10 times their size, has got 10 times the economic might. They've been able to hold them back by embracing the technologies, but it's turned it into a terrible war of attrition where any humans in daylight are immediately attacked by the drones.
I remember seeing, do you remember that moment a few years ago in the Ukraine war when Ukraine managed to put a bunch of killer drones into a lorry, a semi-trailer truck that was in Russia, you know, 1,000 kilometers from Ukraine. It was miles away, but it was near it was delivering some kind of payload to a military base, if I recall correctly, and there were fighter jets and MiGs and things on the base. And when unbeknownst to the truck driver, when the lorry opened up, the back of the semi-trailer erupted with a whole bunch of drones, and the drones went and blew up the Russian jets on the airfield, and everyone cheered.
Which is why you need AI, and said,
"This is incredible." No, these were Ukrainian drones. It was a targeted thing. You know, we thought, "Well, this is great. This is like the little guy suddenly being able to." It's the democratization of war, in effect, because now the little guy can use drones to take out these hundreds of millions of dollars worth of military hardware. And I read a piece by an American military analyst saying, don't celebrate too quickly because we are the country that has the best, most expensive military hardware. And someone else is going to use exactly the same tactic to use drones against us. You know, we don't actually want a democratization of warfare if we're the United States. We want old-fashioned brute force to be the dominant thing because that's what we have. That's what America's good at. America doesn't need to be nimble. America just needs to be, you know, America wants a world in which having a massive big fist to punch with works.
I agree. I mean, there's two things to learn from that incident, which one of which is that we were thousands of kilometers deep into Russian territory, which is why increasingly you want the drones to have autonomous capabilities because you can't control them from 1,000 kilometers away. They've got to be able to make their own decisions and target themselves. So that's first of all, that's why there is an incentive, military incentive, to make these systems increasingly autonomous. And the second is the realization that one you just mentioned, which is we are going to be on the receiving end of these technologies. They're not going to be, it's not like buying F-35s or nuclear submarines. These are cheap bits of kit. The intelligence comes from the software, which is going to be, you know, is not going to be expensive to obtain or steal from someone else.
Mm.
And so we will have to defend ourselves against these capabilities. So it is going to be terribly destabilizing to the current balance of power. It won't be just, you know, the US that can send in the aircraft carriers and
send
strike
in drones.
Force. Iran was becoming a major drone power. Turkey has become a major drone power. The latest ship that the Turkish Navy launched was a drone carrier.
Really?
Yes.
Who needs an aircraft carrier?
Exactly.
When you can have a drone carrier. Well, wow.
You can project your force with a drone carrier.
Amazing. In fact, you mentioned
it. And it's interesting. It's interesting that how did Turkey become a major drone superpower? It's they provide, you know, many of the drones in Ukraine are Turkish drones now, possibly to both sides even, which is, of course, you sell weapons to both sides, but anyway. So they tried to buy drones from the US. They tried to buy, you know, Reaper.
Who, the Turks did?
The Turks did.
Right.
And they were turned out on human rights and various other, you know, we don't trust you too well.
Yeah.
So they said, well, okay, we'll build them ourselves. And the son-in-law of Erdogan, the Turkish president, had just done his PhD at MIT on aeronautics.
Wow.
And he's now the technical lead on developing drones for Turkey. Well, imagine if your son-in-law of Erdogan, you know, resources are not a problem.
No, exactly.
Doors are open for you.
Foreign university students. I knew I didn't trust them. Now we've got, that's exactly why. I'm going to go back to their home countries and create drone armies. You mentioned Iranian drones. I was reading that a lot of the strikes that are taking place right now throughout the Gulf states from these Iranian drones, actually, that these are, like Bahrain was here. Dubai Airport and a fancy hotel in, was it Abu Dhabi?
The Fairmont.
That's right, the Fairmont in Abu Dhabi was struck by these Iranian drones, which you may know more than I do about this, but the reporter was saying that these Iranian drones were good enough in their day that the Americans reverse engineered them, actually. And part of America's drone program was a reverse engineering of these Iranian drones and rebadging them with a different name. And the Iranians were also selling them to Russia too. So, yes, I mean, this is not just about ballistic missiles being fired, is it? It's already about drones.
As with those drone attacks deep into Russian territory, increasingly those drones aren't radio controlled. Because if they're radio controlled, they're easy to stop. You can jam the radio.
Right.
Right. And if you're in the Ukraine, if they're radio controlled, you find where the radio signals are coming from, and you send artillery down on the drone pilots. They're the most hated people on the battlefield. So by making them autonomous, you make them a much more capable, much more difficult weapon to defend against.
And by autonomous, presumably they still need GPS?
No.
They don't. So they don't need satellite either.
They do use GPS. That's a fantastic way of navigating. But GPS is easy to deny.
That's where I was going.
That's going to happen.
Yeah. So how do they know where to go?
Just like your Tesla car does. It uses cameras. Visual recognition of the landmarks underneath them.
Oh, so that really is AI. It's not just a navigation routing. It's actually making decisions.
I mean, of course, there's also some inertial navigation, right? So you know where you start, you know where you've, you know what
roughly
direction,
how fast
roughly,
you're going,
and, roughly what the wind is,
where you've been gone. Wow.
But that's imprecise. But they said they'd be using a lot of, increasingly using computer vision to identify landmarks on the ground.
And when you said that you suspected that something as precise as the taking out of the Supreme Leader of Iran, you know, is only possible because of technological advancements, and I said, well, I thought it was sort of human intelligence. What's the intersection there? What is your hunch about how...
Well, it would have been human intelligence that gave away the coordinates of Khamenei. And they would have, I'm sure they would have only done it when they've got it confirmed by two different sources.
Mm.
But then to be able to offer the precision and speed of attack at that particular coordinate would have used some, you know, autonomous guided systems of some form.
Yeah. But I thought we had those pre-AI. Like when we saw the skies igniting over Baghdad in 2003.
Yeah. That was the beginning of precision.
Yeah, those were self-guided missiles as well, weren't they? Yeah. They weren't just you have to aim it in the correct direction and then hope that it gets there.
Yeah, they would find their way through the window and things like this.
Yes, right. So, what are the big differences that people are working on now? I mean, when we're talking about Anthropic not wanting,
well, I think the big difference is being democratized. So, as you say, Iran has got these weapons. I mean, it used to be you had to spend a couple of million and buy yourself a Tomahawk missile.
Right, yeah.
Only the US had Tomahawk missiles.
Mm,
mm. Now everyone can, you know, buy a cheap drone and get that sort of accuracy.
Technologically speaking.
Yes.
Big advances? Because when I think about, you know, when I first heard the term ChatGPT, you know, which was probably 2022, maybe something like that. And it was this novelty where you could say, you know, tell me, you know, say, give me, tell, say Mary had a little lamb, but in the style of an American Revolutionary War soldier or something. And it would, you know, it was a party trick. And then it got better and better and better. And only, you know, within the past 6 months has it become something that I interact with as if it was a sentient thing. Capable of.
Oh dear.
I'm not saying it is, but
the problem is we're easily fooled.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we increasingly will think it's sentient.
Yes.
And people are. You know, this is what troubles me that people are starting to form what they feel is meaningful relationships with these sentient beings.
Yeah. I don't have a meaningful relationship to it, but I do have a relationship that's akin to a relationship I might have to a research assistant who I don't really like very much,
but I don't socialize
with. But you know, they're just there. It's not like one of my beloved inner core. It's not like my producer or my, you know, someone who I actually have a human relationship with.
Don't say please and thank you and worry about
not really
asking things nicely.
I used to, and then I just sort of fell off the bandwagon a bit. I feel like if I'm being demanding, I say please, but if it's just a normal request. Then I do.
I mean, one of the problems there is if that flows over into our real lives.
Yes.
So we become more demanding.
Yes, I do worry about that.
You become more demanding of your real human existence because so
it's a thing.
It's a thing, right?
Yeah. No, but do you not engage as if the AI was? I only mean engage as if it was sentient in the sense that it is able to iterate and understand my commands as well as a human is when we're bouncing ideas back and forth, usually. And so I guess I just mean to say that is so far from Mary Had a Little Lamb in the style of the American Revolutionary War soldier that I try to transpose that onto the battlefield and think about, well, what is it that armies and the Pentagon and, you know, the brightest people in the Pentagon are trying to mold these systems into doing and possibly succeeding in doing that is as different from the, you know, the night sky flashing up over Baghdad in 2003 as my relationship to ChatGPT.
They're starting to use them to help them war game and strategize. Right? So, you know, and that itself is troubling. I mean, there's been troubling research that's come out of King's College London recently, where they got all of the leading models to play war games and said, you know, what happens if you put them in some, you know, well-developed military situations? And 95% of the time, they resorted to tactical nuclear weapons.
Did you have to add the caveat that we don't want everyone to die in the world, that nuclear holocaust is a bad thing? Maybe they forgot that.
These were only tactical nuclear weapons.
Just tactical.
And half the time.
What could possibly go wrong?
Half the time is all-out nuclear war, I think.
Yeah.
95% of the time.
Well, when you start with a tactical nuclear weapon, it is difficult not to evolve.
In some sense, you know, it's like, I'm unsurprised, right? These are trained on the internet. In the internet, they're a mirror of what they're trained on.
But they're also trained on every military strategy book that's ever been written.
Yes, but they're trained on half the internet. And people are pretty aggressive and confrontational on the internet. So unsurprising. They're not very, you know, they're not very diplomatic. They don't back down. And, as we've seen for ourselves, when you have a disagreement on the internet, it quickly becomes, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, but I don't think AI is Twitter. I don't think AI has to...
But it's trained on Twitter.
In part.
Yes.
In part.
Yes.
But if you go to Twitter and you say, I'm having a problem with my uncle because my uncle is a big fan of the far right and I don't know how to communicate with someone who is that racist, then Twitter will come back and say, you're the fucking problem. Your uncle is great. Libtards need to die. But if you go to AI and say that, it will give you useful information about human communication, empathy.
Except, again, they're trained to be rather sycophantic, to be rather confirming. And so they don't necessarily push back as humans do against you, which is why, you know, I think that it's troubling that we are trusting upon them. It's troubling that we are having relationships with them, because relationships, you know, sometimes you're the person who's making
mistakes.
People have to push back against you.
Thread on Reddit. It's like, yeah, you often are. Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, it does, when you think about war games, it feels to me that like a lot of the cases that you've made thus far in this conversation have to do with the claim that AI just isn't as good as we think it is, that we shouldn't trust AI on warfare because it's not as sophisticated or nuanced as people are, on wargaming, for example. We shouldn't trust it on pushing the button to kill someone because it's going to make mistakes more than people would. But
my reservation go beyond that, though.
I'm equally interested in the case, even if it were better. Like, even if it were more strategically nuanced.
I think at some point we should entertain the idea it would be better, right?
Yes.
Because humans are terrible.
Yes.
Right? We're terrible at making irrational decisions.
Yeah, and let's suppose we can prove
And we make vile decisions as well. If you look at the history of warfare,
absolutely,
people have done obscene things.
We are apes. We are primates.
Right,
let's suppose you have an AI that controls drones that can do the what's going on in Iran right now, or you know what was happening in Gaza, and you can guarantee, because you've run so many virtual tests of this, that it's 10x more accurate in minimizing human casualties than human beings are. It's not perfect. They'll still happen, but you're going to get 10 times fewer, less collateral damage if you let the drones do the killing than human operators do the killing. Humans just can't see what's in that building the way that drones can. They can't make the inferences that drones can. They don't have the scale of information and the speed of judgment that the AI, not the drone, does. Then what's the objection?
I think there are two objections. The first one is these weapons will fall into the hands of our opponents and they'll maybe have no qualms about removing those safeguards. So now we've got this incredibly deadly weapon without those moral safeguards. So that's the first one. And the second is the way that it changes the character of war, that it will make warfare a much quicker, much deadlier activity. We've seen that in the past. You know, we see that there's various things that we can invent. We've invented that would have made warfare more deadly activity, and we've decided to ban because of
chemical weapons,
biological weapons. Yeah. One of the very first things that was banned, dum-dum bullets. They were a more effective way of
causing. What are dum-dum bullets?
They're bullets that when they go into your body, they explode and cause huge shrapnel damage to your internal organs. So they cause, they're much more destructive.
Landmines.
Yeah, we're cluster munitions. I mean, there's a host of things where we decide, actually, no, that's changed the character of war in a way that we find distasteful. And we've decided, therefore, we should try and limit to some extent. And I think the same would be, because otherwise I could tell you what warfare will be, which is, as soon as war starts, all the humans are dead. Because we don't have the precision, the speed, the accuracy that the AI will have. And so humans will be, any humans that happen to be around the battlefield will be dead.
Right. That's not a good outcome.
I don't know. We fight war according to some rules, which is strange, but we do. And, you know, to try and, you know, constrain, you know, the horrors of warfare. But it would be incredibly horrible at that point, as far as I can see.
But then it strikes me that the real problem is the asymmetry and the fact that it would fall into the hands of unscrupulous, probably non-state actors. Because yes, the reality
would,
is that
and it would be
if Putin wanted all the Ukrainians dead, then he could have just gone in and he could have made it more like Grozny. I mean, he could have just gone around assassinating everybody from day one, and he could have dropped a tactical nuke on.
Apparently, they've been trying to assassinate.
I mean, I'm not
President
saying
Zelensky since day one.
Well, Zelensky, sure, he's the leader, but I just mean the civilian. There could have been. We're appalled by the lack of concern for civilians in Ukraine and in Gaza.
We should also be appalled by the lack of concern for the Russian soldier.
Certainly, absolutely.
I mean, the meat grinding
completely,
of Russian soldiers.
Completely.
Goes on.
Yes.
Because they don't care.
Their leaders don't care any more than they care about Ukrainian lives. But this is still happening in a context in which there is at least some level of lip service to the idea that you don't intentionally target civilians the way that a terrorist does.
Exactly.
And so if Putin or Netanyahu had AI that was capable of immediately killing everybody on the battlefield, presumably they wouldn't use it because they haven't used the tools that they do have that would come close to that. So isn't the concern just that people, that a terrorist would get it? I mean, isn't that?
But it's not just terrorists, Josh. We began the podcast by talking about taking out of the supreme leader of Iran. They were doing exactly that. They are taking out people individually.
I don't have a huge moral problem with taking out the supreme leader of Iran. I have a problem with international law. I have a problem with, many problems with the way that Trump conducts foreign policy, but
we're talking about how the character of war is changing, which is now we have technologies and precision to be able to do things like that.
Isn't that good?
In the Second World War,
World War, you would have had to blow up all of Tehran to get the in order to get Hitler and Goering, you would
Berlin. We didn't have the technology to be able to say, let's take out Hitler. I mean, there was an assassination attempt from within Germany on Hitler, but we didn't have the precision. And also the intelligence as well, to be able to say, okay, Hitler's here, we can take him out tomorrow.
No, you're winning me over to the opposite side of your position, Toby. Now I'm thinking it would have been great if we could
What I'm persuading you is war is changing.
Right. Okay.
Now we have, because of technologies like AI, we have the precision to do these things. Now, whether that's the right thing from a stability of the world perspective, a military perspective, from a moral perspective, is another thing.
Right.
But we now have technologies that change how we can fight war, where we can actually say we can take out the leader now.
And it won't be long
to do that.
Yeah, it won't be long before the US president is constantly under threat of being taken out themselves, because there's no Secret Service that's going to be able to make them impenetrable.
Funny enough, when I started to get involved in the debate around autonomous weapons, I thought this was going to be the easy argument. I thought politicians would quickly realize they are going to be the targets.
Yeah.
Therefore, it's in their interest to ensure these technologies are suitably regulated, because otherwise it's them.
Yeah. Why have they not got that memo?
Well, I think they might be starting to get that memo now. It took them longer to realize. 10 years ago, I realized that was where we were going to end up.
Yeah.
We are now certainly at those points.
I mean, you know, people are already afraid in the United States, in the Republican Party, of standing up to Donald Trump because he'll shout at them on Truth Social, and all of a sudden some, you know, maybe one of his crazy followers will drive halfway across the country to the lawmaker's house and, try to inflict violence on them. Well, if you lived in a world in which everybody can get online a killer drone that can go and assassinate that lawmaker without them having to drive halfway across the country and, as was the case for Nancy Pelosi's unfortunate husband, get smashed in the head with a hammer by a deranged lunatic. If they could just press a button and a drone could do it for them, then it would probably have the effect on political assassinations that guns have had on everyday killings in the United States, whereas it just makes it much, much, much more common because it's so much easier.
Or it'll probably start with someone's AI agent, which misguidedly decides that what we wanted was to go onto the dark web and order a drone attack on our political opponents.
Yes, that's a more strange Lovian outcome, perhaps. I mean, I suppose...
It comes to the point, which is... We're already seeing the breakdown of the rules-based order, but we're seeing technology which is going to come along and change what we can do. And I think, make the world, again, a less safe place, a more difficult place.
So I guess the argument that you probably hear a lot from Democratic leaders is not dissimilar in its shape to the argument that Anthropic makes about its other adversaries, its other competitors in the AI race, which is, if we don't keep developing the technology, other people are going to, and we'll be better than them.
Prisoner's dilemma.
Yeah, exactly. Right?
You will end up in a terrible place that no one wants to be because no one can trust the other person.
Well, exactly. If we don't make these drones, the Chinese and the Russians and the Iranians aren't going to stop, so we'd better be as well equipped as they are.
Yes.
It's an arms race.
It is, but the analogy I like to use when people suggest the futility of avoiding this terrible outcome, this terrible equilibrium outcome that we get into. You say, well, what about chemical weapons? Because chemical weapons is not a technology that's difficult to obtain. You can go to your hardware store and get the rudimentary basis of a very simple chemical weapon. It's not knowledge that's, it's high school chemistry, graduate level chemistry. You don't need a lot of technical sophistication. You don't need a lot of resources. And yet chemical weapons are not widely used, despite the fact that it's a technology which could easily be misused by lots of bad actors, largely because, I think, because we have actually regulated its use. And if people do, and occasionally they do in Syria or elsewhere, use chemical weapons, there's universal condemnation, there's resolutions on the floor of the UN, there's front page articles in the New York Times, threat of a distant court in The Hague. And most importantly, arms companies aren't openly selling them because they don't want to end up on a UN blacklist because there's plentiful ways they can make money selling legitimate arms, which they do. Why would they then want to risk being sanctioned by the United Nations or someone for selling chemical weapons? So chemical weapons are not openly sold, and terrorist organizations are not known for having large research organizations to develop chemical weapons and means to deliver them. So they buy what's readily available on the black markets of the world. And so I think we could hope for the same with autonomous weapons. We could hope for the same, which is, it's not going to be a technology that we can constrain. But if we decide collectively as a planet that that's morally repugnant and put in some safeguards, then maybe that will limit the worst excesses.
What's the morally repugnant thing, though?
Oh, it's easy. It's easy. I say to people, it's easy to imagine what's going to be morally repugnant. It's going to look like a bad Hollywood movie. You're going to turn on your TV and they're going to go to the news reporter in Gaza or Ukraine or Doha or wherever it is, and you see a swarm of drones taking out a schoolyard of children. And you think, oh my God, that's being done in my name? Or, we're not doing anything about preventing that happening because it will be a bad Hollywood movie.
Yeah, but I'm still stuck on the point that we can already do that, and we don't.
We can do what?
We can already take out a schoolyard of children.
Yeah.
And we don't. So whatever the rules are that we're obeying, then why wouldn't we just impose the same rules on the AI?
I hope we do.
But then isn't the AI not the problem, but our military and political decision-making? Like, I don't understand why... Autonomous weapons equals mowing down children in a
schoolyard.
Well,
because they change the speed.
If we already have the power to mow down children in a schoolyard,
they do,
and we don't choose to do that during war.
They're making it ever quicker, ever more accurate to do that. So previously, if you wanted to fly, several drones in, you needed several pilots. now you don't. You can just fly them autonomously.
Yes. I mean, again, this is coming back to where I think the real...
Right. The US Air Force employs more drone pilots now than pilots of any other type of aircraft. And soon it will be more drone pilots than all the other pilots added together. So there'll be the US drone force, not the US
Air Force. No, I understand. And none of them is or ever has mown down children in a schoolyard. You know, just as a strategy of targeting civilians during war.
Well, there are some leaked videos that suggest that all of the targets were legitimate. But anyway, that's a challenge for the U.S. military, which is, you know, you've got to train those people, you've got to employ those people, and those people are harmed. I mean, interestingly enough, PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, amongst drone pilots is greater. Occurs at a greater rate than amongst fighter pilots.
Mm.
It's more damaging to fight those and kill those people on a TV screen than it is actually to be there in the cockpit doing it yourself.
Mm. That's interesting.
Well, I mean, there's various reasons, you know, why you could expect that to happen. I mean, there's the disconnect, right? So you're in a container in Nevada flying these drone, killing people on the ground, you know, hopefully terrorists, but, you know, whoever they are. Then you go back to your family home and have dinner in the evening. It's strange.
Yeah, yeah.
Strange world that you're in.
Yeah.
That you're having to switch between.
Mm. And there's no danger to yourself.
And then the maybe distance between, yeah, and then yeah, the distance exactly. between
maybe
yourself.
If you're in a fighter jet, at least you feel like you're part of a battle.
Yeah, and and
you could get shot out of the sky.
Right, you justify to yourself the fact that you're killing people because your own life is at risk.
Yeah,
at that
exactly.
Point, right?
Yeah.
It's me or them, right?
Yeah.
It's obviously got to be them. But, you know, sitting in a container, pressing a button on a joystick, I've got no skin in the game, right?
You just have to urinate into a bag. That's the worst that has to happen in your container in Nevada.
Yeah.
But it strikes me that we're still confusing the democratization of warfare and the risk that these technologies will carry if they fall into the hands, which they invariably will, of terrible, either terrible states or non-state actors like terrorists, with the likely outcome of Western democratic militaries using AI to improve their objectives, whatever those objectives might be.
Right.
That's why I'm sort of getting stuck on the point about, like, you know, shooting children. Like, children may get attacked by swarms of drones, but it's unlikely that that's going to happen because a Western military decided that it wanted to inflict suffering on a civilian population to achieve a political end.
Right.
Because we already don't do that.
But let's agree before we move on that they're already falling into the hands of the wrong people, right? So the fact that Iran can retaliate and take out, you know, an airport, a hotel in Dubai or wherever it was, is because they're using drones. Right? But previously, they would not have any capability to respond at all. Right? But now they have got a capability to respond and cause harm.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's only going to increase over time.
Yeah. I'm still stuck on the prisoner's dilemma of feeling like if they're going to be doing it, then I want us to have the best equipment with which to respond. And maybe autonomous drones are included in that toolkit.
Why is this any different to chemical weapons? We should be using chemical weapons?
Well, I think chemical weapons is trickier, isn't it? Because the hardware is different. Like, the hardware with chemical weapons is chemicals.
Yes.
But the hardware with a lot of these systems is identical to the stupid version of the thing, isn't it? So, you know, a drone is a drone, whether or not it has a clever brain in it, AI brain in it or not. So
it's not such a potent weapon, right? So regular drones today in Ukraine are useless.
Right.
Because this electronic jamming is so sophisticated now, you cannot fly them. They immediately get stopped.
Mm.
So they're either, you know, flying off fiber optics, which can't be jammed so easily, or they're increasing the autonomous.
So what kind of a model of restriction is best from your point of view? Because because of that problem that the hardware is often the same stuff, essentially, how do you police? I can imagine policing chemical weapons and certainly policing, you know, rare types of weapons like uranium and stuff like that and plutonium. What exactly does one police in the enforcement, suppose we had an international set of rules around AI?
I think there are a few easy places to begin. So command and control of nuclear weapons. I think that's like...
That's a no-brainer. I'll sign up for that. Even if the AI is better than people, I still don't want it controlling nuclear weapons.
Humans in the loop in deciding to start a nuclear war. Right? I think, you know, we could all agree to that one. But just to point out, we haven't all agreed to that. So Russia is developing, I've got prototypes of, maybe it's even in service now, of the Poseidon autonomous underwater submarine. Things the size of a bus. It's nuclear powered, so it can travel unlimited distances, very high speed. It's much smaller than conventional submarines because, you know, it's uncrewed, so you don't need all of that. So it's very stealthy, and it's believed that it will contain a cobalt tipped nuclear device. So you could drive this thing into Sydney Harbour or up the Hudson and take out half of New York City.
Wow. And not a nuclear missile launcher, but a nuclear device on it. So the submarine itself explodes.
Blow itself up, take out half of Manhattan. Because it's a submarine, you can't communicate with it, right? Radio waves don't work underwater. Mm. If it comes to the surface, it reveals itself, it easily gets destroyed. So its decision-making will be using algorithms. And it will have set off 1, 2, 3 a week ago before from the Baltic Sea to travel stealthily across the Atlantic to go up the Hudson. And then...
And it doesn't realize that
in the meantime
the premier of the Soviet Union, this reminds me of Strangelove. I mean, it's literally the plot of Strangelove, that the Soviet Union devises a doomsday machine that cannot be turned off, that we will just detonate itself automatically, that humans are kept out of the loop.
But you do ask yourself, what is going through the minds of the Russian military or Putin to think that this is a useful weapon? I mean, what circumstances, what sort of capability is this? Why would you ever conceive of using this? Or how does this give you military advantage? Just the existence of this thing. It's hard to understand.
I guess it's probably a defensive strategic tool, much like all nuclear weapons are, which is that they're not actually very useful to use, but having them is really useful to stop actors from doing other conventional things that you don't want them to do.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so the reason, partly we know about this is because Russia had an internet naming competition for it.
Here's a tip, Vlad. If you want to keep something secret, don't invite public submissions on the name.
Yeah, so that's why it's called Poseidon, the god of the sea.
Should have been called Subby McSubface.
Nuky McNuke.
Nuky McNuke face. Wow, that's amazing.
So
you've got systems like that.
So I think that's an easy place to start.
Yep.
And another place that you might want to start is autonomous weapons that target humans, as opposed to autonomous weapons that target military hardware. So, we do already have autonomous weapons that target, the radar cross-section of an incoming fighter missile or a tank, on the ground. But things that are designed to target humans in particular, things that are designed to target specific humans based upon specific characteristics, maybe their face, right? So, I thought politicians would easily be persuaded, right? When it's targeted with, it's using facial recognition of particular people's faces to do the targeting.
Yeah, that is frightening, isn't it? I mean, I came into the country yesterday and, it's been many years since you had to talk to a human being when you come into Australia and many other countries. You just stand in front of a facial recognition thing and the gates open, it lets you in. So if it's that easy and that cheap to scan your face and identify you with close to 100% certainty.
It's the classic problem we have with artificial intelligence, which is the same algorithms on your smartphone that opens the phone your face, right?
Yeah.
That's a great convenience. And it's secure because, it's your face.
Mm.
So it means you don't have to remember passwords and all that. Mm. You can do it when you've
got... put that on a drone.
Right, but
say,
just put that on a drone. It's the same
Toby
algorithm.
Walsh, stop him from talking about
classic,
all this anti
This is classic
nonsense.
Dual use problem we have with AI, which is, that's a good thing, right? It's made our lives more convenient.
Mm.
It's great. People with disability, you can use phones now without having two hands to do things. Great. But equally, we'll take the same algorithm, we'll put it on a drone, and we'll start killing particular people.
Mm. And not just particular people, but I think we've spoken in the past about, you know, the possibility of if you were up to ethnic cleansing, for example,
yes.
you could just get drones to target yeah. all Asian people and,
yeah, or,
you know,
or pinky people
round
like
them
us,
up, or yeah, or white people or whatever. You could have them
or Chinese people,
out of the
whatever it is, right? Any whatever yeah. characteristic, or women, or all children, you know, all people wearing a turban, all purple,
yeah,
all people, you know, with a beard, whatever it is.
Yeah, this is like Pol Pot. Who rounded up everybody who wore glasses and, you know, put them in concentration camps or killed them because wearing glasses meant that you were an enemy of the people because you were a snobby, elitist intellectual.
Which is one reason why I'd say that in some sense this is more troubling than previous technologies. I mean, we've had other weapons of mass destruction. We've talked about chemical weapons, nuclear weapons. Those are very, they're not very discriminatory. A chemical weapon will kill everyone in the neighborhood, right? But suddenly we've got a weapon of mass destruction because it will be able to, you know, the great thing about computers, if you can do something once, you can do it 100 times, 1,000 times, you just put a loop around it. You know, if you've got a drone that killed one person, 100 drones will kill 100 people, 1,000 drones will kill 1,000 people. So suddenly we can scale warfare. So, you know, in some sense, that is a weapon of mass destruction. But now we've got an incredibly high precision discriminatory weapon of mass destruction where we can say exactly who we kill and who we don't.
Right. And so the advocates of that would say, that's great because we can kill Hitler or Khamenei and we can target them. But I suppose the opponents would say, but then it lowers the bar to doing that because you don't, you might be reticent to wipe out an entire city with a nuclear weapon,
yes.
but you might be less reticent to deploy something more targeted.
So yes, I mean, we haven't talked about that, but it potentially lowers the barriers to war. Right. So if you feel that you can, now we can do things that you previously couldn't do. And we see that in Iran.
It's going on right now.
Right.
Yeah.
Previously we thought, oh, well, it's impossible. We can't guarantee we're going to take out the leadership.
Mm.
Well, now we can pretty much guarantee we are going to take out the leadership.
That's right. And if the collateral damage was 100x what it is today, 10 years ago, then you would also worry about alienating the Iranian people more than
the moral question
of killing civilians. And
How many civilians are we allowed to kill to take out the leader? Well, if it's very few, then it justifies doing that.
Yes. Yes, I heard something on the radio about some civilian apartment complex being hit in Iran and, you know, some dozens of civilians dying in these Israeli and American strikes. And whilst I was sympathetic, I did somewhat sort of think, I mean, it's not very many in the context of historical wars, is it? Like, I mean, that, you know, it's terrible for the people, but as far as war goes, the real news would be if not a single civilian lost their life when the world's greatest superpower, you know, launched a major combat operation against another country.
It reinforces the point that technology is changing the character of war. What we thought of as war, right? So war used to be about, you know, how much pain you were willing to put up with, and it was against your civilian population as much. Now we have, you know, a surgery in place where we can precision strike things.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's lowering the barrier to going to war. There's also lowering the cost of war, both financially and in terms of your civilian lives compared to the other civilian lives. And this comes back to the question of asymmetry. As long as we live in a world in which one side has vastly more technologically advanced military equipment than another, they're going to be able to go to war with much greater impunity because they're obviously going to care less about their adversary's civilians than they are about their own. So if you can guarantee that almost none of your guys lose their lives, then it becomes somewhat beside the point how many of your enemies do, doesn't it? Depending on
where,
how
where at the
you
moment,
are.
Though, there's a real asymmetry. And this is part of the problem, which is there's an asymmetry for the aggressor against the defender. It's actually quite hard to defend yourself.
Yes.
And so we don't have many good defenses against a swarm of drones. You can overwhelm most conventional means of defense if you come at someone with 50 drones, right? You can take out a few of the drones, but some of them will get through. So it's not so easy to defend yourself, and it then incites you to, well, I should be the aggressor then.
Right. Turns everyone into a paranoid.
Yes.
Yeah. That's interesting, isn't it? Because, it's one thing for Iran to retaliate by lobbing a missile into the suburbs of Jerusalem as they did and killing, you know, a few dozen Israelis. But if there was a swarm of 1,000 killer drones flying along a Tel Aviv beach, blowing up civilians, that would be a very different story. Mm-hmm. And we may not be that far away from a world in which that's not more expensive than the missile that they dropped. Yeah. All right. So no AI on nukes, no AI that can target human beings, only infrastructure and assets.
Yes.
Is there any other rule of thumb that you would want to impose?
I think that's a good place to try and start the world to say, okay, there's something we can do in this space, as opposed to, you know, often people's initial reaction, which is like, we can't possibly do this. No one else can agree with us, and we're going to just put ourselves at a technical disadvantage.
And are there forums in which these things are properly being discussed?
Well, funny enough, I'm getting on a plane.
I didn't actually mean to tee you up to your impending journey this afternoon.
To the United Nations of Geneva, who for the last 10 years have been talking about this and slowly trying to build some consensus in the international community around, we should do something about this. This is, we've done things about other technologies that it would be worthwhile trying to get some consensus together.
Yeah.
The problem there, of course, is that United Nations works by looking for, you know, complete consensus, and the US, China to a certain extent, Russia certainly, and a few other nations have probably felt that they've got a technical lead that they should try and hold on to.
Mm.
I think that's foolish, because if you look at the history of military technologies, no one has held on to a technical lead for any length of time. You know, the US thought they were going to have a technical lead with the hydrogen bomb. The Russians had stolen within a couple of years. No technology has ever been kept to one side of
That's interesting. Yeah. I mean, and there were voices, weren't there, after the Manhattan Project, saying that instead of racing for a hydrogen bomb, they should immediately, halt the American nuclear program and talk to the Russians about not getting into an arms race. And the world probably would have been a lot safer if there weren't thousands of hydrogen bombs sitting around.
Yeah.
Is there any receptiveness from any countries that matter?
Well, over 100 nations have called for...
I said ones that matter.
Matter. The European Union, the African Union.
Okay, that matters.
Austria, Belgium, to a certain extent Germany, the German foreign minister. The problem is, you know, we don't exactly live in a rules-based order anymore.
No.
So does it... If, you know, the US's position, which it seems to be at the moment, which is we are going to be forceful and force wins over everything else, then, you know, it's a reflection of the world that we're in.
Do you think that the Pentagon's desire not to, or refusal to accept Anthropic's limitation on the use of autonomous killing machines indicates that they are doing research on it, or do you think it just indicates a natural sort of military desire not to be pushed around and not to have to follow rules because we're going to do what we want to do and you can't tell us what to do?
I'm pretty convinced that the US military didn't want this to happen. This is the Secretary of War.
They didn't want the break to happen.
Yeah,
they want the split up to happen.
Because Claude is their favorite tool.
Yeah.
And
so why did they stand firm against
and the two limitations that Anthropic were insisting upon were probably not constraining them in any meaningful way.
So
they've just signed a $200 million contract now with OpenAI.
Yeah,
to do exactly the same. So it's just inconvenient.
But they haven't accepted the limitations, right? Because I mean, the OpenAI is willing to allow the Pentagon to do whatever.
Well, OpenAI will claim that they've got those two clauses in the contract, but it's a watered down version of those two clauses.
Yeah, so I'm just still a bit baffled about what happened. Was it just a matter of hubris?
Well, Sam Altman has stabbed Dario Amodi in the back.
Right.
You know, he was negotiating with
I mean, I understand what happened with the OpenAI. I mean, of course, OpenAI is going to come in and pick up the
$200 million.
Yeah, of course. I mean, why would they not? But what I mean is I'm still unclear about what the actual contours of the dispute between the Pentagon and the Trump administration on one side and Anthropic on the other side were, if the two conditions that Anthropic was insisting on were sort of moot either way? Why did the Pentagon take such a harsh stance on not agreeing to them? Why didn't they just agree? Or was this just Trump trying to
Pete Hegseth first.
Pete Hegseth trying to boot Anthropic?
Yes.
Kick him in the teeth?
Yeah.
God.
I mean, this usual Trump term two presidency, which is you try and bully people.
Hmm. How do you get...
But it's, I mean, it's unprecedented. They've never used the Supply Chain Act to go against a U.S. company before. You know, supposedly they were in bed with big tech. They all lined up at the inauguration behind the president. Suddenly the discovering is, you know, it's not so easy to be a friend with the Trump these days. unreliable friend.
Well, I mean, I would have thought that once an AI company is working with the Pentagon, that it's been insinuated into all of their systems already.
Well, they are. And, you know, Trump's now saying every part of government has to withdraw from using Anthropic, not just the military.
It's not going to happen, is it?
I mean, why would you harm, you know, one of the most successful AI companies that's helping drive the economy in the US by...
But also, how much money are you going to spend on uninstalling it from every system that you've got?
The DoD contract was about 10% of their revenue. So it's a non-trivial amount of money. Wow. Then if it goes to all forms of government, since they're focused on enterprise, that's going to be a significant chunk of their revenue. But equally, you know, we'll see how it's going to unfold, but it's...
I feel like I need to go out and get a paid subscription to Claude just to, as a principled attempt to bolster Anthropic for having stood up to them.
And there's a reciprocal campaign now to desubscribe from ChatGPT.
Yeah, yeah, good.
And supposedly, I looked this morning, hundreds of thousands of people had desubscribed from ChatGPT as a response to them, you know, signing the contract with the DoD.
What's the worst case and sort of best case scenario that we end up with on AI and warfare? Like, you've sort of painted the worst case.
Is a bad Hollywood movie where we see swarms of drones being used to attack civilians, being used by terrorist organizations, being used by rogue states to cause, you know, significant harms, and a world that's really destabilized by this technology. Because it's not, as we keep on saying, it's not going to be just the military powers that have the capabilities. It would be everyone and their dog who can call upon these technologies. And if you're a terrorist organization, I mean, the interesting thing is the US military keep on saying, oh, well, we're going to use this technology responsibly. And I'm sure they will. They test, there's significant testing and that they go through before they actually use any artificial intelligence in the US military to make sure that it's being used in lawful ways. But the problem is that if you're a rogue state or a terrorist organization and you've got a weapon system that's only 50% accurate, what do you care? It's that's a more terrorful weapon.
Mm.
If it kills half the people it kills and not the intended targets, well, that's what terror is about, right?
Yeah,
you don't care.
Yeah.
If you're the US military, you're only going to deploy it when it's 99.99, you know, 5.9s or whatever it is, accurate.
Right. So the terrorists will do it first.
Yes.
Yeah. And there's no way that you can defend. It's not like you can create an iron dome that fires missiles out of the sky what you're dealing
with. We're back to this asymmetry, which is it's much easier to attack, to launch a wave of, you know, hundreds of cheap drones and one of them will get through and cause harm.
And it's actually much easier to defend yourself against a nuclear ICBM that's flying towards you than against, you know, a bunch of 1,000 drones, drones that are swarming around. Because at least there's a chance of shooting the ICBM out of the sky. There's nothing you can do about 1,000 drones. All right.
The positive picture is, you know, it's used for mine clearing. It's used to get supplies into contested territories. It's used to, you know, help you more efficiently, more effectively defend yourself. You know, so, I mean, we think AI is recent, but AI has, you know, been around for 56 years. I remember when Desert Storm happened, I was at one of the big AI conference that year, and the US military have always been the biggest funder of AI research historically. I remember various generals turning up to that conference saying, the Desert Storm paid for all of AI research ever. I say, what way did it pay for US research? I say, well, we used one scheduled AI scheduling algorithm to get the stuff out to the Gulf, get the soldiers, the bullets, the ready packed meals, everything out in the right order, the right amount at the right time. And we did it so much more efficiently than the last conflict that the billions of dollars that we've ever spent on AI research has been paid for.
Wow. Wow. And Jeff Bezos woke up and thought, I could do that to sell books and I could use the logistics to, on-time delivery.
Yeah, well,
I mean, it is incredible.
Like, yeah, because militaries are essentially, logistics with fighting capability.
Yeah.
Right? It's all about armies fight on their stomachs. It's about making sure you've got enough bullets, meals.
It's FedEx. It's FedEx, right?
So it's
Amazon
a major
Prime.
Logistics operation.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? And it's a very demanding client because if you turn up without the bullets, you're in trouble.
This is not good. Yeah. No, it isn't. I mean, it isn't.
So you can see that
there's
going to be some fantastic, I've always said, we're not going to not have AI in the military. I accept fully the AI is going to do some really useful stuff in terms of defending ourselves, in terms of more effectively delivering, help into disaster zones and also saving lives. No human should ever go and clear a minefield. Put a robot on the job.
Absolutely.
And indeed, we're developing, Data 61, Sarah, developing a mine-clearing robot. So, if it goes wrong, robot gets blown up, go and get another robot.
Yeah.
No one should risk a life or limb clearing a minefield.
Fabulous. Lastly, Toby, I just want your thoughts about sort of how we govern ourselves and...
Badly? Do you want more adverbs?
Is it apocryphal, the old line about, was it Gandhi who was asked what he thought of Western civilization?
It'll be good if when it comes.
Yeah, he said, I think it'd be a great idea. But no, in the future, as AI gets better at noticing patterns and helping us to strategize and helping security agencies identify threats before they become threats, maybe even going into demographic and sociological things where, this person who has these genes that are normally associated with violent behavior, who was a troubled child.
We're going down to minority report.
Yeah, all this sort of minority report shit, right? Let's keep an eye on. I mean, look, the Bondi terrorist attack, right? This is still an open wound here in Sydney, and there's a lot of recrimination about the intelligence failures that led up to that.
Right.
Why was a person who went to a very extreme mosque and was obviously very, very devout, he went to the southern Philippines, which is a hotbed of terrorism, and then came back and was allowed to own 6 guns? Like, why was there not an AI that was pinging, or a human, but an AI is, cheaper and can ingest more data that flagged, you might want to take a look at these guys earlier.
This is a great debate we need to have.
Yeah. So suppose...
You're right. With some joined up intelligence, we could have easily stopped that. The 9/11 terrorists were known.
Yes.
And again, joined up intelligence would have identified them before the attack happened, right? So yes. But the problem is the same joined up intelligence can be misused by authoritarian governments for stopping any dissent.
Yeah.
Right. So how do we walk that line? That's not a technical question. That's a question about governance and democracy.
Yes. That's why I said how I want to ask you about politics, because if you get good enough data about all this stuff, you can imagine a world where there's a significant push towards a more authoritarian form of governance to keep us all safe, especially if individuals are super empowered to pull off mega terrorism quite cheaply, thanks to drones. Like if it does become possible for an individual to launch drone warfare, biological warfare, chemical warfare, using nothing but the dark web and things that they can buy at a hardware store.
And the AI that helps them plan it.
Then even if only 1,000th of 1% of the population wants to do that, the need to track those people and catch them beforehand, given the scale of what they can pull off, will be so pressing that you can imagine people tolerating a large infraction of their civil liberties in terms of what governments do. You said that the Pentagon might already be surveilling Americans. It's entirely possible that we'll submit voluntarily to AI surveilling us all in order to...
Snowden showed that they were.
Yes, exactly. That's right. The Snowden stuff. Yes, they were already doing it during the Bush administration.
Right. Yeah. And now they've got artificial intelligence on top of that, which can do it in a much more sophisticated way.
To be fair, that was a scandal, so it's not a foregone conclusion that they would do it unselfconsciously, but they're certainly willing to do it.
So they were tapping into, you know, telephone calls and various other communications. Now you can put on top of that artificial intelligence, which allows you in a much more semantic, sophisticated way to listen to those conversations.
Well, they were just to be, you know, perfectly pedantic about it. They were looking at the metadata of conversations. They weren't listening in on Americans' conversations without a warrant, but they were, nonetheless, you could interpret it as being unlawful seizure to look at all of the telephone records of all Americans. To
just knowing who's talking to who is quite telling.
Yes, that's right. How do you think about that in your role as sort of thinking about the future of AI, about how do you reduce the risk of rogue individuals from becoming super empowered to do evil at the same time as you maintain civil liberties and don't allow governments to become big AI institutions that are using mega data to spy on us all and catch the bad guys and in the process enslave us all accidentally?
I mean, these are tough questions. And of course, technology is helping give us privacy as well. Let's not forget, it's not a one-way street, right? So cryptography is, you know, we're getting better and better tools to actually guard our privacy, to stop people listening to us and to, you know, to think dangerous thoughts, because democracy dies if we can no longer think dangerous thoughts.
Well, Uncomfortable Conversations is the name of the show, Toby. It's always lovely to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure.